And then she told me that her granddaughter... John, are you listening to me?
Of course I am, Mom.
Well, then why are you on your phone, ignoring your poor mother who only loves you and wants to spend time with you?
I was doing some banking on the Wells Fargo mobile app and I got carried away. Pay your bills? Done. Check your balances? Done. Deposit checks? Done. Even send and receive money? Are you updating your status right now?
With the Wells Fargo mobile app, it's easy to get banking done. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/getbankingdone. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., member FDIC.
Blog Talk Radio.
After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
You're listening to the Revolutionary Radio Project. With your host, Rob Skiba.
All I'm offering is the truth.
Hello and welcome to the Revolutionary Radio Project. I am your host, Rob Skiba, and tonight we will be doing Virtual House Church 9. And you can go to virtualhousechurch.com and check out the readings that we'll be doing tonight. They are from the Torah, Genesis 37 through chapter 40. And in the prophets, we'll be doing Amos chapter 2, verse 6 through Amos 3, 8. In the New Testament, Acts 7, 9 through 16, and Revelation 12, 1 through 17. And the way it works is I will play an audio recording from, and I'm taking these recordings from Bible.is. I'll put that in the chat room as well. Bible.is. It's a really cool online resource where you can pick the translation that you prefer and pick the different types of audio they have there. They have some just a straight reading, some with reading with music behind it, and some have a dramatized version, which is the one that I like to use just to keep things interesting. And the dramatized version that we'll be using is from the English Standard Version of the Bible. And so what I do is I play the audio for each chapter, and then I hit stop, and I encourage input from you. And if you would like to participate, you can call in at 619-789-6815. That's 619-789-6815. This is meant to be a virtual house church. My wife and I attend a regular house church. We meet at our friend Kevin and Amanda's house on Shabbat each week, Saturday afternoons. And what's really cool when people participate is the dialogue that can take place. Sometimes it takes you in many different directions, but it's really cool to share insights. You will have insights on the scripture that I will not have, and I'll have insights that you will not have. And when we all are able to share with one another, we learn a lot more that way. I've said it before, I've been doing this house church thing for a little over 2 years now, and I'm 43 years old, been in the church my entire life, actively involved, and I've learned more doing this type of church than I have in all the years prior, combined. And so my hope with the virtual house church is to get people from all around the world to attend and listen in and interact. And so I need your participation. Again, please call in at 619-789-6815. All right, so in the meantime, when I don't have audience participation, I will read from a Torah portion study done by an individual named Ardell from a website called yourlivingwaters.com. You can go to yourlivingwaters.com. My wife's been printing these off for me, and they've actually been pretty cool. It helps to fill the dead air, but it also, he's got some good insights to share as well. So Without further delay, let's just go ahead and get started with Genesis chapter 37.
Genesis 37. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them,
"Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf."
His brothers said to him,
"Are you indeed to reign over us, or are you indeed to rule over us?"
So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream, and told it to his brothers, and said,
"Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me."
But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him,
"What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?"
And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph,
"Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them."
And he said to him,
"Here I am."
So he said to him,
"Go now. See if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word."
So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him,
"What are you seeking?"
"I am seeking my brothers,"
he said.
"Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock?"
And the man said,
"They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'"
So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another,
"Here comes this dreamer.
Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams."
But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying,
"Let us not take his life."
And Reuben said to them,
"Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him."
That he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers,
"What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh."
And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said,
"The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?"
Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said,
this we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not.
And he identified it and said,
"It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces."
Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said,
"No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning."
Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard.
All right. Lots of cool stuff in that chapter. If you want to talk about it, give me a call, 619-789-6815. In the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and read something here from the YourLivingWaters.com website. It says, "The story of Joseph always coincides with Hanukkah." Now, this is supposed to, we were supposed to have been doing this study actually a couple weeks ago, which would have been during Hanukkah. We're still playing catch up right now. So, but normally this particular Torah study reading coincides with the holiday of Hanukkah. "One begins to search for a connection between these two stories, which at first glance appears to have nothing in common. The name Hanukkah has two meanings. First and foremost, it means dedication, because it was on Hanukkah that in 165 BC, the temple was purified and rededicated to the service of Yehovah after many years of pagan defilement. Its other meaning, however, we may find very interesting in light of what we have been studying. Huna means they rested, and Ka, composed of the Hebrew letters for 25, Kaf and He, means 25th. This points to the date for the feast of Hanukkah, which is December 25th, or 25th of Kislev. And that's what I've been telling people. I'm like, if you really want to celebrate something on December 25th, forget the pagan holiday that has more to do with Nimrod than Jesus that we call Christmas, has nothing to do with the birth of Christ. On December 25th, you got this interesting story of the Maccabees, where Antiochus Epiphanes had set up a statue to Zeus in the temple and offered up a pig on the altar, defiling it. And then 3 years later, to the day, on December 25th, the Maccabean revolt took place, and they took out the Romans, and they tore down the statue of Zeus, and they rededicated the temple. So if you want to celebrate something on December 25th, get your family together, have a good time, put lights up. It's called the Feast of Lights, or the Feast of Dedication. That would be a good thing to do. Although Hanukkah was a rest, it was really only a reprieve between battles. Physically, the Jews overpowered the Greeks. They were able to rededicate the temple and settle for a moment. However, like the story of Jacob, this would develop into another conflict, a conflict which turns out to be a spiritual battle. Jacob was not able to settle and find rest because his children were at odds with one another. Jacob faced many trials in his lifetime, but none as bad as when Joseph's brothers began to act on their hate. No war is as bad as a civil war. Jacob knew how to deal with attacks by Esau and Laban, but he was at a loss when it came to dealing with the battle that raged in his own home. Hanukkah repeats Jacob's story. In addition to the physical victory the Jews had over the Greeks, Hanukkah continues with the spiritual battle of Jew against Jew. 1 Maccabees 2:27 and 28 says, "Whosoever is zealous for the Torah and maintaineth the covenant, let him follow me." Secular Jews invited the Greek influence into Jerusalem. Hellenization, I've always found that word interesting, Hellenization, crept into the temple service. Many Jews began to embrace Hellenistic culture and all the worldly things it had to offer. Thus, they assimilated and settled into that system. Hanukkah turned into a struggle for the spiritual soul of Israel. It was a war fought in defense of the ritual of circumcision, the observance of Shabbat, the study of Torah, kosher eating, and purity of the temple service. If that war had not been fought, there would not have been a Jewish state for Yeshua to be born into. Those straying from the Torah saw Hellenization as a comfortable way of settling and a way of unifying with the world. And you notice they keep mentioning the word settling, and that's because this week's story by Yeshev means he dwelt slash settled. That's what this actual Torah portion is called. So that's why this author keeps using the word settled and drawing our attention to it. But unity does not mean conformity. Unity does not mean we have to sacrifice our beliefs and ideals and accept the way of the majority. Again, we can find a connection with our study. There was no unity between Joseph and his brothers. Joseph walked a different path from his brothers. They hated him because of his dreams. Genesis 37:8 says, "And his brothers said to him, 'Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?' So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words." Notice this verse references dreams, yet it follows the telling of only Joseph's first dream. Obviously, this was not the first dream Joseph shared with his brothers. Joseph's dreams gave him a vision of the future. Joseph's dreams were prophetic. It seems strange that Joseph dreamed about harvesting grain. Joseph and his brothers were shepherds and not farmers. Why would Joseph's dreams make his brothers uncomfortable, even to the point of hatred? Through the telling of his dreams, Joseph raised the possibility that there would be a great upheaval in their life, and that would completely change life as they knew it. Joseph knew that Jacob would not be able to settle in the land where his father was a sojourner. Note Genesis 37:1. Because of the prophecy given to his great-grandfather Abraham in Genesis 15:13, then he said to Abraham, "Know certainly that your descendants will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them for 400 years. Joseph was aware that the Almighty had stated that his family was headed for an alien environment, far from the promised land, with new circumstances and under new conditions of life. In his first dream, he prophetically saw the unity of the family preserved, yet the dreams pointed to him playing a leadership role. And this is something really cool. As the beloved son of the father, whose brothers hated him, Joseph is about to give us one of the most phenomenal pictures of the Messiah, Yeshua. The following comparisons are slightly edited from something this individual took from a website called HebrewForChristians.com. Now, these are some comparisons, and I'm going to read the ones they have here, but I would just encourage you to do your own. See if you can think about how many comparisons you can come up with between Joseph and Yeshua. Just think about the life of Joseph and think about the life of Yeshua and just get a pen and paper out and write out how many parallels you can see. I had never done it a day in my life, and when I came into this Torah portion study for the first time, the question was asked of the class, how many parallels can you find? And I came up with, I think, about 25 just off the top of my head. It's pretty amazing, but I'm going to read the ones that he has here. Joseph was a shepherd, Genesis 37:2. Yeshua is the good shepherd, John 10:11. Joseph was beloved of his father. Jesus is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased, in Matthew 3:17 and 17:5. Joseph was anointed by his father, and he was given a coat of many colors in Genesis 37:3. Yeshua was anointed as Messiah ben David, Hebrews 1:9 says. Joseph was hated by his brothers, Genesis 37:4. Yeshua was hated without cause, John 15:25. Joseph's brothers refused his rule in Genesis 37:8. In Luke 19:14, Yeshua says, "We do not want this man to rule over us." They were talking about Yeshua there. Joseph's brothers were jealous of him in Genesis 37:11. It was out of jealousy that the chief priests had handed him over, according to Mark 15:10. Genesis 37:12-14 says that Joseph was sent out by his father. And we, of course, know that Yeshua was sent by his father in John 5:30-36. Joseph's brothers conspired to kill him, Genesis 37:18. We see in Matthew 27:1, the chief priests and elders of the people conferred together against Yeshua in order to bring about his death. Genesis 37:19-20 tells us that Joseph's brothers disbelieved him. And we see that Yeshua's brothers did not believe in him either in John 1:11 and John 3:18. Joseph was stripped of his robe, Genesis 37:23. Yeshua was stripped of his garments and made to wear a scarlet robe, Matthew 27:28. Joseph was cast into a pit, Genesis 37:24. Yeshua spent 3 days in the heart of the earth in Matthew 12:40. And actually, if you take a tour of the Holy Land, if you've got a good tour guide, they'll show you where he actually spent time in a pit under Caiaphas's house. It was quite a moving experience. If you ever get a chance to do it, I highly recommend it. It's quite an experience. Joseph's brothers ate a meal while he was in the pit, Genesis 37:25. The brethren ate the Passover while he was in the grave in John 13:1. Speak of Yeshua. Joseph was sold for pieces of silver in Genesis 37:28. Judas was paid 30 pieces of silver in Matthew 26:15. Joseph was raised from the pit in Genesis 37:28. Yeshua was raised from the grave in John 20. Joseph was made a slave in Genesis 37:28. And look for a comparison for Yeshua in Matthew 26:15 and Philippians 2:7. Joseph was taken to Egypt to avoid being killed in Genesis 37:28. Of course, baby Jesus, Yeshua, was taken to Egypt to avoid evil Herod, who was trying to kill all the babies, Matthew 2:13. Joseph was covered his robe with blood. His robe was covered with blood in Genesis 37:31. And Yeshua's robe was covered with blood, according to Mark 15:17. Joseph was made an overseer in Genesis 39:4. And Yeshua, the Father loves the Son and has placed all things into his hands, according to John 3:35 and Matthew 28:18. Joseph made no defense, Genesis 39:19. And Yeshua gave no defense and no answers, according to Isaiah 53:7 and Luke 23:9. Joseph was imprisoned with two others, in Genesis 40:2-3. And we see that Yeshua, there's two others who were criminals who were led away to be put to death with him in Luke 23:32. And, of course, Joseph was falsely accused, Genesis 40:15. And so was Yeshua, falsely accused, Matthew 27:23, Mark 15:11-15, Luke 23:21-23. There are many, many, many more parallels. That's just a few that this individual had listed. I would encourage you to do that. Just go ahead and see how many you can come up with. It's quite an interesting study. Now, I'll keep reading what this guy says here. Judaism teaches that there will be two messiahs involved in delivering Israel from its exile and ushering in the messianic era. These two messiahs are called Messiah ben David, Messiah the son of David, i.e. the reigning king, and Messiah ben Yosef, which is Messiah son of Joseph, i.e. the suffering servant. When unbelieving Jews speak of the Messiah, they are usually referring to Messiah ben David of the tribe of Judah, who will usher in the kingdom of Jehovah and rule in the Messianic age. And if you haven't got a chance to listen to the shows that I did with Dr. Russ Haup, or Pappy as he prefers to be called, I would encourage you to go look through the archives and listen to the Epidemic episodes that I did. They're called Epidemic. This is 3 or 4 of them, I think. And you'll get an understanding of why Jews say Jesus is not the Messiah. And when we hear that as Christians, we all freak out. And you know, it's blasphemy to us. But what you got to understand is that when the Jew's saying that, he's looking at Messiah as reigning king. And Yeshua didn't come the first time as a reigning king. He came as a suffering servant, as the sacrificial lamb. In fact, when you open up the book of Revelation, the beginning of the book opens up with us seeing him in heaven as the lamb. He doesn't become Messiah in the sense of king until the millennial reign of Christ. So you got to understand, we're talking semantics here, but when you hear a Jew say that Jesus is not the Messiah, understand what he's saying. And rather than let that be a cause for division, we think Messiah, we think Jesus, and we have a different mindset, but understand where they're coming from. Because if you can understand where they're coming from, then you can relate to them in a different way and show them and lead them to the Yeshua that we know, as the suffering servant. Show them Messiah ben Yosef, the suffering servant, Isaiah 53. Obviously, King David's life foreshadows Messiah ben David. However, Messiah ben Yosef is said to come first. Judaism teaches that this Messiah will not be recognized. Messiah ben Yosef will war against evil and be killed like Yeshua. His death will be followed by a period of tribulation for Israel, and then Messiah ben David will appear to avenge his Messiah ben Yosef death and inaugurate the Messianic kingdom. Messiah ben David will restore the temple, regather the exiles of Israel, and bring peace to the earth. What we know to be truth as believers in Yeshua is that Yeshua already came as Messiah ben Yosef, the suffering servant. He suffered and died for the sake of Israel in a spiritual war against evil. It is the same Messiah who will return as Messiah ben David, reigning king, to bring judgment on the unjust, to gather the exiles, and to restore the kingdom to Israel. Instead of two messiahs coming at two different times, we, as in you and I, as believers in Yeshua, believe in one Messiah, Yeshua, who came the first time as the suffering servant, Messiah ben Yosef, and will return as the reigning king, Messiah ben David. While it is true that Joseph foreshadows Yeshua, he also represents to us a picture of the body of Messiah. It is simple. Yeshua is the head, we are his body. So both Yeshua and his body, the bride, are represented by Joseph in exile. Let's find one example of how Joseph represents both the head and the body. First, let's take note of the jealousy and rejection that the brothers had for Joseph because of the love their father had for him. Genesis 37:4 says, "But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him." Genesis 37:11, "And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind." Now, we can apply this to Yeshua, who was also beloved by his father and despised and rejected by his brethren. Now, we note in John 1:11, he says, "He came to his own, and his own did not receive him." In John 15:24, "If I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would have no sin. But now they have seen and also hated both me and my father. But this happened that the word might be fulfilled, which is written in their Torah. They hated me without a cause." As the body of Messiah, we also have the love of and favor of the Father. It is a part of the Father's plan that his love will provoke our unbelieving brothers to jealousy. Romans 5:8 says, "But Yah demonstrates his own love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Messiah died for us." Deuteronomy 32:21 says, "They have provoked me to jealousy by what is not Elohim. They have moved me to anger by their foolish idols, but I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move them to anger by a foolish nation." Romans 10:19. "But I say, did Israel not know? First Moses says, I will provoke you to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move you to anger by a foolish nation." See how Paul is quoting Moses? Not contradicting him, for those of you who believe that Paul is the great contradictor of Torah. Now take note of the awesome consequences of the Father's plan of provoking to jealousy. Romans 11:11 says, "I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? Certainly not. But through their fall, to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the Gentiles." Now Joseph had two dreams, which appear to imply the same message in two different ways. But are they really the same? Is it possible that Joseph, his brothers, and his father all were mistaken in their interpretation of the dreams? We'll study some insights from Rab Elkanan Samet. Let's begin with a look at the first dream and how his brothers interpreted it. Genesis 37, beginning in verse 7. "There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brother said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams than for his words. There are two methods of interpreting dreams, literally and symbolically, or symbolically. We can deduce from the verses above that the brothers interpreted Joseph's dream literally. They understood the sheaves bowing down to be symbolic of rulership. But what could the symbolism be behind the bowing down? In the following verses, we see that prostration expresses dependence, not rulership. Genesis 23, beginning in verse 7, says, "Then Abraham stood up and bowed himself to the people of the land, the sons of Heth," which, by the way, if you listen to the previous teachings, Heth means terror, the sons of terror. "And he spoke to them, saying, If it is your wish that I bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and meet with Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me. And we learned in previous study that Ephron, the name means fawn-like. So I postulated the idea that this could be he could have been talking to a satyr who dwelt among the terrors. I'm telling you guys, when you look into the Hebrew, there's Nephilim everywhere you look. They're everywhere. Even right there in the account of Sarah's funeral. Ruth 2:10. So she, Ruth, fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" So if the sheaves bowing in Joseph's first dream were to be understood symbolically, they could be expressing the brothers' dependence on Joseph during the years of famine and during their stay in the land of Goshen in Egypt. The sheaves are a symbol of produce and of bread. Notice in Joseph's dream, the sheaf suddenly stands out. This is referring to Joseph's remarkable rise in status in Egypt. Notice then that the other sheaves gather around Joseph's sheaf and bow down to it. They are totally dependent on Joseph, who is the distributor of bread. We can go to a higher level and continue the pattern until we see the end times famine in another light. And I think I'll stop right there. I see somebody in the studio here. Would you, let's see, looks like Amy. Hello?
Hi, I was just listening, sorry.
Oh, do you have anything you want to share? Did anything stand out in anything?
I think that you're doing a great job comparing Joseph to Jesus. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and have you ever tried that?
Yeah.
Have you ever tried that?
No.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I would encourage you to go out and just get a pen and paper and give that a shot, because you'll come up with a whole bunch of them. Pretty wild. I mean, it shows how he came as a suffering servant, modeled to us in Joseph. So when we read about Joseph, we're looking at like a type and shadow, something for us to understand more about the Messiah.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. And hey, Dory, I see Dory's in the chat room too. Call in 619-789-6815. So I'll go ahead and play the next chapter unless you have anything else you want to share.
No, but thank you.
Okay. All right. Let's go ahead and play Genesis 38 then. This is an interesting chapter, because Genesis 38 is like this commercial break. You got Joseph being sold into slavery, and then all of a sudden you're following the story of Joseph, and then boom, the story switches and starts talking about Judah. So let's see what Genesis 38 has to say.
Genesis 38. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Kizib when she bore him. And Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan,
"Go into your brother's wife, and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother."
But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he went in to his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground, so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law,
"Remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up."
For he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told,
Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep.
She took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said,
"Come, let me come in to you."
For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said,
"What will you give me that you may come in to me?"
He answered,
"I will send you a young goat from the flock."
And she said,
"If you give me a pledge until you send it."
He said,
"What pledge shall I give you?"
She replied,
"Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand."
So he gave them to her and went in to her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of the place,
"Where is the cult prostitute who was at Enaim at the roadside?"
And they said,
"No cult prostitute has been here."
So he returned to Judah and said,
"I have not found her. Also the men of the place said, 'No cult prostitute has been here.'"
And Judah replied,
"Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her."
About 3 months later, Judah was told,
"Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality."
And Judah said,
"Bring her out, and let her be burned."
As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law,
"By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant."
And she said,
"Please, identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff."
Then Judah identified them and said,
"She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah."
And he did not know her again. When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying,
"This one came out first."
But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out, and she said,
"What a breach you have made for yourself."
Therefore, his name was called Perez. Afterward, his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah.
Okay, let's go ahead and dive into this. Now, we were just talking about how we could go higher in the pattern of understanding the dreams. So I'll pick up where we left off there. We see in Amos chapter 8, verse 11, "Behold, the days are coming, says Adonai, Jehovah, that I will send a famine on the land, not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but of hearing, Shema, the words of Jehovah." In other words, it'll be a famine of not being able to hear the words of God. In the future, could the world be dependent on a body of believers represented by Joseph, who have stored up the words of Jehovah for those hungry for hearing the word? The brothers asked the question, "Shall you indeed rule over us?" If Joseph himself understood the dream, he should have answered, "No, but the day will come when I will provide sustenance for you and your children." See, I hope you see the difference here. Now let's look at Joseph's second dream. Genesis 37, beginning of verse 9. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. We know that Jacob's household has been chosen as the nation to bring the light to the world. Isaiah 42, beginning in verse 5, says, "Thus says El Yehovah, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk on it. I, Jehovah, have called you in righteousness, and I will hold your hand. I will keep you and give you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the Gentiles. From the second dream, we can again see that the survival of Jacob's household is dependent on Joseph. For in Egypt, Joseph does not only care for his family's physical needs, but he also provides a place for them to survive spiritually. Joseph keeps the dream of returning to the land alive by preserving a longing in Jacob's household for the land of their forefathers, by organizing Jacob's funeral procession back to Canaan, and even by commanding his brothers prior to his own death. In Genesis 50, verse 25, then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, Elohim will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. And Exodus 13, 19, and Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under a solemn oath, saying, Elohim will surely visit you, and you shall carry my bones up from here with you. So Joseph's second dream is about light and keeping the promises of the covenant alive. Yeshua came as Messiah ben Joseph, being our light through which we obtain light to fulfill the promise of being a light to the Gentiles. John 8:12 says, then Yeshua spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. Now, I'm not sure about this. I'm going to have to go check it out, but I'm thinking that this was taking place when Yeshua went to the Festival of Lights, which is Hanukkah. And that's another reason why, you know, we may be looking at this at that time. I'll have to go check that reference again. Don't quote me on that, but just off the top of my head, I'm thinking that he was literally at the Festival of Lights, which is Hanukkah, when he said, hey, I am the light of the world. Very interesting that that's the Torah portion reading, just so happens to correspond with Hanukkah. Matthew 5:14, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. We can conclude that Joseph and his family all misinterpreted his dreams. They were not the same dream. The first dream pictured survival through the sustenance of Joseph. The second dream pictured the suffering servant, Messiah ben Joseph, who is the source of light for Israel. Joseph would come to an understanding of his dreams the hard way. He would be sold as a slave. What he would learn is that any greatness he has ascended to would be granted to him by the Almighty. This high position was granted to him for the benefit of others, not for his own enjoyment. And despite his power, Joseph was still a slave. Note what Philippians 2:5 says, beginning in verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which is also in Messiah Yeshua, who being in the form of Elohim did not consider it robbery to be equal with Elohim, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Now that we are well into the story of Joseph, we are about to be interrupted. And that's where the chapter we just looked at, chapter 38. Chapter 38 appears to be an independent island within the greater story of Joseph. And, of course, chapter 39 will pick up exactly where chapter 37 ends. Genesis 39 through 41 recount more than 20 years of Joseph's life in Egypt. Meanwhile, we are left without information about what has been occurring in Jacob's family in Canaan. To avoid this imbalance in focus, chapter 38, the story of Judah and Tamar, provides us with events that run concurrent with those of Joseph's life in Egypt. It's kind of like the TV show 24. If you ever watched that show? Every episode is 1 hour of real time, so whenever Jack Bauer is doing something, the bad guy's doing something, they want to show it both at the same time, they split the screen so you can see, you know, two things happening at once. It's kind of what we have going on with the story of Joseph in Genesis 37 and 39 and following, where there's this kind of interruption, just like we see in the TV show 24, where we see a split screen, where we see Joseph, you know, his deal in slavery, and then meanwhile, elsewhere, there's a situation with Judah and Tamar. And now, Joseph and Judah together, their lives provide a prophetic summary of all of Jacob. This explains why the stories of Joseph and Judah are what follow the second verse of our study, as opposed to the normal listing of descendants, where we saw in Genesis 37:2, it says, these are the generations of Jacob. And chapter 38 probably covers about 20 years. At the beginning of the story, Judah marries a woman and has children. Now, before I continue there, because there's a lot to talk about in that, there's a couple other things, and I apologize for kind of jumping around here. I had lost one page prior to going to this chapter, and I meant to talk about earlier before we went to chapter 38. But there's some cool stuff in this entire section, week 9 portion. We see in Genesis 37:12 that Israel's sons were sent to pasture in Shechem. Now, if you go back to the extra section of the Virtual House Church, you'll see, and if you listen to some of the earlier sessions we did, what I believe regarding Shechem, that it is actually the place where it is now covering over the area where the trees in the garden were, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the tree of life, I believe, is buried underneath Shechem, specifically under the mountains of Ebal and Gerizim, with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil under Ebal, which is where the Israelites were to pronounce the curses, and the tree of life being under Gerizim, which is where the other half of the Israelites were put to pronounce the blessings. It's just my belief. It's something that I've been tracking down in my research that I find interesting. So I do find it rather cool that there it shows Israel's sons are gone to pasture in Shechem. So Joseph goes to look for them. Actually, in the beginning of it, it's kind of funny too. It says that beginning of chapter 37, that Joseph basically tattletales on the children of Bilna and Zilpah, his father's wives. And if you look up and see who those descendants are, that's rather interesting as well. That's like Dan and Naphtali, where Dan and Naphtali were the sons of Bilna, and the sons of Zilpah were Gad and Asher. So it's interesting that Joseph, who is a type of Yeshua, is tattletaling, sort of telling his father about the bad things that Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher are doing. There's some interesting prophetic significance there. And so Joseph goes looking for his brothers in Shechem, and he meets a man. So, and it's an unnamed man who's there. And he says, no, they went on to Dothan. And the word Dothan, it's a city, but the word Dothan means their sickness. Interestingly enough, it's also the place where the floating axe head occurs in 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 13. And there's some pretty wild connections there with regard to the Antichrist. I'm not prepared to talk more about that right now, but we actually talked about it quite a bit in one of our Torah studies, and if Kevin was here, he could talk a lot more about it. But just a lot of very interesting parallels that we're seeing here. And, of course, we see that his robe was dipped in blood. And next time we see Yeshua, in Revelation 19:13, his robe is dipped in blood. So there's another parallel there. And the question I had, though, a lot of people, we look at this, the testimony of Stephen in Acts chapter 7, where he says that that Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery. But go back and read Genesis 37. Who sold him into slavery? It doesn't say that his brothers sold him into slavery. They put him in a pit with the intent of selling him into slavery. But then they went and had something to eat, and they looked up, and they saw some Ishmaelites in the distance walking, like a caravan. And then it says that, meanwhile, some Midianite traders passed by in Genesis 37:28. It says, then some Midianite traders passed by, and they who? The Midianite traders pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. And so they were the brothers were out elsewhere having something to eat when they saw this caravan coming, and they said, hey, let's go get him and sell him. And then verse 29 says, when Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, the boy's gone. So you see that they're surprised because they had an intent to sell their brother, but Midianites beat them to the punch. And so Midianites sold them to the Ishmaelites. But then when you go down to verse 36, it says, meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guards. So it appears that he switched hands a few times, and I believe the book of Joshua covers this in a lot more detail. I don't have the reference in front of me right now that explains all that. But, of course, the Ishmaelites would be, half-brothers, as sons of Abraham, So It appears the Midianites sold him to the Ishmaelites. The Ishmaelites must have realized that he was kin and sold him back to the Midianites, who then sold him in Egypt to Potiphar. Pretty wild stuff. But we're always taught, oh, the brother sold him to slavery. But, I mean, I've read this several times. Every time I look at it, it's telling me that the Midianites did it. So, go figure. Okay, those are just a few other random notes that I had set aside here that I thought were interesting about chapter 37. Now, as we get into chapter 38, this is a wild story dealing with Judah marrying a Canaanite. Now, we see earlier that that was off limits, you know, that Abraham was told, don't marry a Canaanite. You know, well, Abraham actually had Sarah, so already with him. So Isaac was told not to marry a Canaanite, and Jacob, don't marry a Canaanite. So there's all these, you know, previous examples where they're told not to marry a Canaanite, who are Nephilim. But, of course, you know, the Messiah is coming through the line of Judah. So of all the 12 sons of Jacob, who marries a Nephilim? Judah. And he produces three sons from that union. Now, this is a really amazing story. My wife refers to it as Operation Leverage. And I actually wrote about this in my book. Oh, by the way, book two is done. Yay! Book two is done, and we've put an order in to the printer, and we should have them sometime next week. So they are done and available. So if you'd like to get a copy, you can go to BabylonRisingBooks.com, and right at the top you'll see a link that will take you to book two. And I put a chapter in there called chapter 9 called Protecting the Line of Christ. And in this chapter I talk about this Operation Leverage thing. And I'll go ahead and read some of it here. In Torah class, we discussed the idea at length of whether or not Tamar was a Canaanite. Now, we know that Judah married a Canaanite, but then it says he took Tamar to be a wife for his three sons. But it does not say that Tamar was a Canaanite. And so that's what I'm talking about here. In the end, the room was fairly divided, with some thinking she was and others saying she wasn't. No one had definitive proof for their position, and that drove me crazy. So home we went. The next morning, my wife suggested we look up what her name meant because we remembered from our trip to Israel in 2005 that there was a place called Tamar. Well, Strong's Concordance, Strong's number 8558, yielded the meaning of this word as palm tree or date palm. The word also carries with it the connotation of erect or upright. Okay, either she was upright or she was a palm tree. Keep looking. What about Joshua? Yes, let's check the upright book. It was there, once again, that a Genesis gap got filled in. We see in Joshua 45:23, it says, and in those days Judah went to the house of Shem and took Tamar, the daughter of Elam, the son of Shem, for a wife for his firstborn son, Er. Mystery solved. Judah chose Tamar from the lineage of Shem, who had lived in Jerusalem as the Melchizedek. Now, that's the Melchizedek that you read about in Genesis chapter 14. We find that Melchizedek was a title for Shem. He was the righteous king. To be a wife for his oldest son, Ur. It would appear that she was destined to be an ancestor of the Messiah. Notice, however, how Ur was described. Genesis 38, 6 and 7 says, and Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Now, this is firstborn of the Canaanite, who was a Nephilim. Whose name was Tamar, a wife for Ur, whose name was Tamar. And Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and Jehovah slew him. There's no mention of why Ur was considered wicked in the sight of the Lord. Could it be that it wasn't anything he did, but rather who slash what he was? If he was the offspring of a tainted female, Canaanite, Judah's wife, could he have fallen into the 50% of the Nephilim Punnett square? You have to go look at my previous studies that we did on the female Nephilim Punnett square. You know, I've got some graphics there you can check out in the extras section on the Virtual House Church. So could he have fallen into the 50% that was corrupt? It is pure speculation on my part, but I strongly suspect that he was. Ur does not produce any children by Tamar because he was considered wicked in the sight of Jehovah and was therefore killed by him. What does Judah do with Tamar next? He follows a tradition that would later become a law. that we see in Deuteronomy 25, 5 and 6. It says, if two brothers are living together on the same property and one of them dies without a son, his widow may not be married to anyone from outside the family. Instead, her husband's brother should marry her and have intercourse with her to fulfill the duties of a brother-in-law. The first son she bears to him will be considered the son of the dead brother, so that his name will not be forgotten in Israel. Judah gets his second son, Onan, to marry Tamar in order to produce an heir for his brother. But Onan doesn't want to produce an heir for his brother, so even though he has sex with her, he always pulls out and spills his semen on the ground. In context, therefore, the real quote-unquote sin of Onan, some of you probably heard about that in Sunday school, the sin of Onan, as a teenager, probably. In context, the real sin of Onan, therefore, is not masturbation, as many a Sunday school teacher would have us believe. No, it was the fact that he broke the law and dishonored his family. We see in Deuteronomy 25, 7 through 10, it says, but if the man refuses to marry his brother's widow, she must go to the town gate and say to the elders assembled there, my husband's brother refuses to preserve his brother's name in Israel. He refuses to fulfill the duties of a brother-in-law by marrying me. The elders of the town will then summon him and talk with him. If he still refuses and says, I don't want to marry her, the widow must walk over to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal from his foot, spit in his face. Then she must declare, this is what happens to a man who refuses to provide his brother with children. Ever afterward in Israel, his family will be referred to as the family of the man whose sandal had been pulled off. Onan took Tamar as his wife according to the Levirate tradition, but he refused to impregnate her. Instead, he just used her for pleasure, and God killed him for this. Could it be that Onan was of the 50% who, according to the Nephilim Punnett Square, may have been pure? If so, could it be that had he not done what he did, he may have been a forefather of the Messiah? We will never know. What we do, however, know is that unlike the issue of Ur, who simply was something wicked in the sight of the Lord, Onan appears to have been killed for something he did. This left Tamar as something akin to used goods. Judah has now lost his two sons. His youngest son, Shelah, is still too young for marriage at this point. So Judah sends Tamar back to her father's house to wait for Shelah to grow older. Poor Tamar has been used twice. She will never get another husband. Her only hope is in Shelah. So she waits for him to get older. Judah, however, begins to have second thoughts because of what happened to his older sons. Maybe Tamar is cursed. He doesn't want to take a chance on losing his only remaining son, so he decides not to call for Tamar when Shelah is of age. Realizing this, Tamar feels robbed and wants what is rightfully hers. She comes up with a plan. Operation Leverage. Genesis 38:12-16a says, some years later, Judah's wife died. After the time of mourning was over, Judah and his friend Hira, the Adullamite, went up to Timnah to supervise the shearing of his sheep. Someone told Tamar, look, your father-in-law is going to Timnah to shear his sheep. Tamar was aware that Shelah had grown up, but no arrangements had been made for her to come and marry him. So she changed out of her widow's clothing and covered herself with a veil to disguise herself. Then she sat beside the road at the entrance to the village of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. Judah noticed her and thought she was a prostitute since she had covered her face. Apparently that was one of the ways you know a prostitute is because she has her face covered. That was apparently what prostitutes did. And so she dressed up in a way that would make her look like a prostitute, and that's indeed what he thought, according to this verse here. So Judah noticed her and thought that she was a prostitute since she had covered her face. So he stopped and propositioned her. Let me have sex with you, he said, not realizing that she was his own daughter-in-law. Now, if she wasn't dressed up or pretending to be a prostitute, she should have been highly offended by that and smacked him in the face. But instead, she played along and asked, okay, how much are you going to give me? Now, this is one wild soap opera that begins to play out here. When she hears that Judah is coming to a nearby town, she puts on a veil, essentially, again, like I said, dressing up as a prostitute, and gets his attention. apparently quite interested, he offers a goat in payment for her services, which she accepted. Knowing Judah is obviously not a man of his word, though, she wants an assurance that he will make good on the payment. She asks for his signet, cord, and staff. Judah agrees and has sex with her. He then goes back home. Later, Judah sends a friend, Hira, with the promised goat looking for the prostitute, probably because he didn't want to get caught. The people of Shem say, "We have no prostitutes here." So when he returns, he tells Judah that he couldn't find the woman, and Judah basically says, "Oh, well, let her keep it then." He gives up on the matter, probably because any further pursuance of it would have likely brought public shame upon him. 3 months later, word gets back to Judah that his daughter-in-law is pregnant as a result of prostitution. Not putting two and two together, Judah gets ticked off and becomes an extreme hypocrite. He shouts, "Bring her out and burn her." Just as they are going to take her out and kill her, she pulls out the signet, cord, and staff and says, "The man who owns these is the one who made me pregnant." Judah is thus caught, admits that she is more right than he is, and acknowledges that he wronged her. Judah never slept with her again. Now, here's the amazing part. This is what my wife calls Operation Leverage. Jehovah leverages this whole affair in order for the promise to be fulfilled. The Messiah would come through the completely uncorrupted seed of Judah, and he does this through Tamar. Tamar has twins. One starts to come out, and the midwife ties a scarlet cord around his wrist. But then he goes back inside, and Perez comes out first. Perez then becomes the ancestor of Jesus. His name in Hebrew means breaking forth, building a pure nation. This is the reason why Jehovah removed his people, the sons of Israel, from Canaan and brought them to Egypt. Judah had gone astray and mingled pure seed with corrupt seed. That trend would have likely continued, and the infant Hebrew nation would have become just like all the others. Jehovah wanted a pure nation, separated from the influences of the cultures around them, and one not tainted with Nephilim genetics. Apparently, Joseph also knew this. We see in Genesis 45:7, Joseph said, "God has sent me here to keep you and your families alive, so that you will become a great nation." This fact is reiterated when Jehovah reassures Jacob that it is his will that they should go down to Egypt. We see in Genesis 46:2-3, "And God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night, and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down to Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation." Now, once in Egypt, the danger of them mixing with Mitzrayim's potentially corrupt seed was also present for a time. However, the fact that the house of Jacob was altogether in Goshen limited exposure to the native population. When they were eventually made into a colony of slaves, they were even more limited. So in reality, their slavery forced them to interbreed within their own pure gene pool. Essentially, they became a forced reproductive science experiment in Jehovah's lab. In that lab, they reproduced like rabbits, spawning a nation that consisted of nearly 2 million genetically pure Israelites by the time of their exodus. Indeed, as Joseph noted, what men meant for evil, God meant for good. Once Jehovah had his nation fully formed, it was time to release them back into the land that he had promised, to wipe out the Nephilim and begin the process of cleansing the earth once again. And that concludes chapter 9 of my book and leads into chapter 10, Facing the Giants. That's where they go into the land. But it all starts with this little Genesis 38 interruption. Pretty wild story there. If you have anything you'd like to contribute to this conversation, please call me at 619-789-6815. That's 619-789-6815. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of this. And otherwise, let me go ahead and continue reading what this other commentator has to say. He says, again, Genesis 38 probably covers about 20 years. At the beginning of the story, Judah marries a woman and has children. Then at the end, we have the birth of twins, which technically could have been Judah's grandchildren. So these are the 20 years of Judah's life while Joseph was in exile. Our study is focused on these two leaders. Joseph had aspirations to lead the family of Jacob and later does rule as a servant. In parallel, Judah leads during the sale of Joseph and the family during the time of the famine and during the confrontation with the Egyptian viceroy. These two brothers represent those people who would eventually become the two dominant tribes of Israel, Judah and Ephraim. Why Ephraim? This puts a little. This helps us understand Ezekiel 37, the two sticks, which is the study we're going to read on Friday, the Mayan end of the world. Well, actually, it's not the end of the world. They just say it's an end of a age. But it's awfully interesting that while the world's thinking that something major is going to happen on the dark side on that day, that Ezekiel 37 is going to be the Haftorah prophet story that we're going to read. And that's what he's talking about here, the stick of Ephraim, the stick of Judah. Why Ephraim? We shall see later that Ephraim, an Egyptian-born son of Joseph, will be adopted by Jacob and become the dominant tribe. From Judah descends King David and Messiah. But from Joseph and Ephraim descends the line of Jeroboam, the king who rebelled and broke away with 10 tribes. Most of the people from these tribes were assimilated into surrounding nations during the time of the exile. The Almighty speaks of the return of all tribes through the prophet Jeremiah. And Jeremiah 31, beginning in verse 1, says, Jehovah, I will bring the Elohim of all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. Verse 7, thus says Jehovah, sing with gladness for Jacob, and shout among the chief of the nations. Proclaim, give praise, and say, O Jehovah, save your people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I will bring them forth from the north country and gather them from the ends of the earth. A great throng shall return there. They shall come with weeping, and with supplications I will lead them. I will cause them to walk by the rivers and waters in a straight way in which they shall not stumble. For I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. Yeshua began the search for the lost tribes. We see in Matthew 15:24, but he answered and said, I was not sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I'm sorry, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I'm like, that didn't look right. Yeah, he says, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Disciples of Messiah continued to reach out to the tribes dispersed in the exile, who became part of the congregation of Israel, erroneously translated later as the quote-unquote church. Now, this was interesting, too. This guy named Steve Collins, you can look him up. He's done some amazing work tracing the so-called lost tribes, showing you that they weren't lost at all. They knew exactly where they were, and that's where Paul and the other apostles went to. They went to minister to the tribes of Israel that were in the diaspora, that they knew where they were. These are the same people who came from the diaspora to Israel during the time of Pentecost. That's why they spoke in different languages. Remember when the Holy Spirit came down and people were speaking in the different languages, and they said, wait a minute, these are just ignorant fishermen. How is it that we hear them in our language? Well, what are they doing there in the first place? These people who speak different languages are the people from the diaspora coming back to Israel for this particular feast, one of the seven feasts of Jehovah. They weren't lost. That's a myth. Anyway, look up Steve Collins teaching on that. He's got some good stuff. And so we see in James chapter 1, verse 1, James, a bondservant of Yah and of Adonai, Messiah Yeshua, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greetings. So he's writing to them saying, hey guys, 1 Peter 1, 1, Peter, an apostle of Yeshua, the Messiah, to the pilgrims of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Okay, so he's telling them, he's writing specifically to these people. All right, let's get back to the story of Judah. Genesis 38:1. And it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. Notice that Judah went down from his brothers. Immediately, we see a connection to the story of Joseph. And that's where we see in Genesis 39, verse 1, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. The Torah does not explain why Judah went down away from his brothers. We are left to wonder if it was the result of deceiving his father, Jacob, concerning the so-called death of Joseph. Judah is about to make a poor choice for a wife, Genesis 38:2. And Judah saw there a daughter of a Canaanite, whose name was Shua, and he married her and went into her. We know how Judah's forefathers had felt about marrying Canaanite women, Genesis 24:3. And I, Abraham, will make you swear by Jehovah, the Elohim of heaven and the Elohim of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son Isaac from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. And in Genesis 28:1. Then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. So is it now okay for the sons of Jacob to begin to marry outside the line of Shem? We will soon see that Joseph will marry an Egyptian who is in the line of Ham as a wife. What is happening in the Judah story is a picture of how Jehovah intervenes in the lives of his people to accomplish his will. Jehovah's hand in the midst of Judah's choices will maintain the purity of the line that would eventually produce the Messiah. So this guy appears to be in agreement with what I've been saying. Abraham and Sarah were both from the blessed line of Shem and produced Isaac. Ishmael was rejected, Egyptian, because of his Egyptian mother. Isaac married another Shemite, Rebekah, and produced Jacob and Esau. Esau was rejected not for physical reasons, but for heart issues. Concerning Jacob's descendants, instead of having one chosen to continue the covenantal family, the entire family of Jacob is chosen. But only one son will carry the special physical seed through which will descend the Messiah. The rest of the family of Jacob/Israel has the option for now of marrying outside the family of Shem, assuming that their spouse accepts the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, with all that being said, the wife that Judah chose was a problem. See, this guy doesn't get it. He's one of these people, like I said, when we had our class, they were saying that Tamar was a Canaanite. Apparently this guy thinks so too. He says she was a physical descendant from the cursed line of Canaan. Not true. That meant none of their three sons were worthy of being an ancestor. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. Sorry, he's talking about Judah here. I take it back. Now, that being said, the wife that Judah chose was a problem. That is true. Sorry, I recant. She was a physical descendant from the cursed line of Canaan. True. That meant none of their three sons were worthy of being the ancestor, the one from which would come kingship and redemption. The first two sons were evil, Ra. That's what's interesting, too. The word for evil in Hebrew is Ra. It's Resh Ain, Ra. How interesting that that's the god of the Egyptians, Ra. So whenever they talk about their god, Ra, when the Israelites heard the word Ra, they thought evil. Their god is evil. And Jehovah took their lives. Genesis 38:7, but Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and Jehovah killed him. And Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his, and it came to pass when he went on into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did was evil, Ra, in the eyes of Jehovah. Therefore, God killed him also. Our verses tell us that the deaths of both of the sons were because they were evil in the sight of Jehovah. Yet Judah unfairly accuses Tamar of being the one responsible and is unwilling to let her marry his third son. Genesis 38:11. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest he also die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. Tamar waited and expected to be given to Shelah in marriage, but Judah had no intention of allowing the marriage. Judah deceives Tamar, but he is about to be tricked by her. And he just goes on and reiterates what I've already said, so I'll stop there. If you've got anything to contribute to this, please give me a call back at 619-789-6815. Otherwise, I'll go ahead and move on to Genesis 39. Amy, are you there?
I am.
Hey.
I never knew that the word for evil in Hebrew was Ra. That is really interesting. So I just looked that up at the Blue Letter Bible.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, so whenever they were slaves in Egypt and the Egyptians were talking about their sun god, Ra, they were like, yeah, these guys are worshiping evil.
Wow. Boy, oh boy, that's really cool.
Isn't it?
It is.
That's wild.
Oh, wow.
What do you think of Operation Leverage, though? That's pretty cool, too, huh?
Yes, it is. I mean, the way that God works, it's just so amazing. Everything is according to His purpose and His will. I mean, the way that Joseph went in to Egypt, the way that, you know, he taught them so many things just through being there.
Oh, yeah, the story of him being in Egypt, that's another. When he reveals himself to his brothers, it's probably the most beautiful story in the Bible. That's the one we'll do. I'm probably going to do that one tomorrow night. So anybody who's listening and wants to catch that one, will be caught up after I do that. And so the one we're going to do the Friday, the normal virtual house church time, will be the actual Torah portion that's allotted for that day, December 21st. But,
cool.
Yeah, that's probably my favorite story in the Bible is when Joseph reveals himself to his brothers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the way, you know, he sent for the youngest had to be with him. You know,
yep.
Benjamin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just looking at, I'm going to go ahead and read something else I just saw here that's pretty cool regarding the signet cord and staff I didn't see. Let me go ahead and read that.
Okay.
Let's take a closer look at the items Tamar requested. This, again, I'm reading from this this study by Ardell from YourLivingWaters.com. He says, let's take a closer look at the items Tamar requested. The signet. This was a ring used to press into a wax seal to stamp his ownership on his possessions. It was a highly personal object that performed the function of a signature in modern society. A signet was used to make the crown of pure gold worn by the high priest. In Exodus 28:36, it says, "You shall also make a plate of pure gold and engrave on it like the engraving of a signet, holiness to Jehovah." The cord that she requested of Judah, the same word for the thread of blue later required for the fringes on the Israelite garments, as a reminder to keep the commandments. Numbers 15:38 says, "Speak to the children of Israel. Tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations and to put a blue thread in the tassels of their corners." And that that word that's used there is the same word, patil, I think is how you say it in the Hebrew, for cord. So there's some significance there. And the staff. This is most often the word used this word is translated as tribe. Apparently, each tribal ruler led his group with a staff. This suggests that the ruler's staff may have originally been a symbol of the tribe and spoke of leadership and authority. It can be very messianic in its symbolism. Note Psalm 110, verse 2. It says, "Jehovah shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion. Rule in the midst of your enemies." Interesting. This guy goes on to say, "Well, Tamar conceived, and this information is passed on to Judah without even the slightest hesitation. Of course, he pronounces the death penalty and then says, let her bring her out to be burned. And Tamar is sentenced to death along with the twins. Perez is part of the messianic line in her womb. Normally, an Israelite woman would be stoned to death for adultery. Only priests' daughters were sentenced to be burned." And that's interesting because I don't know if this guy makes that connection, but if she's a descendant through Shem, who is Melchizedek, he's a king priest. So how interesting that that was the prescribed method of death for her, was burning. That's the death sentence for the daughter of a priest, apparently. We see that in Leviticus 21:9. "The daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by playing the harlot, she profanes her father. She shall be burned with fire." That Tamar would be the daughter of a priest supports the rabbinical teaching that Tamar was indeed from... Oh, he does get it. Cool. That Tamar was indeed from the lineage of Shem. This qualifies her to be part of the messianic line, which would produce King David and Messiah Yeshua. Cool. This guy, he gets it. "Now can you see the Father's hand in all these events? Judah needed a proper descendant, one not from the line of Canaan. Perhaps as the daughter of a priest during the years Tamar was forced to wait, she began to understand this. Like the matriarchs before her, she takes matters into her own hands to preserve the seed. Tamar's reply is for Judah to look at his personal items, the personal items of the man by whom she became pregnant. Genesis 38:25. When she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." And she said, "Please determine whose these are, the signet cord and staff." At this point, Judah, who had previously seen Tamar as responsible for the death of his sons, recants and admits his error. Where before Judah had assumed his own righteousness and the righteousness of his sons, he now realizes that his actions were not justified, nor were his sons righteous. He exhibits humility in the place of ego. He admits to his deceit following the pattern of his father and recognizes Tamar's good intentions. He says in Genesis 38:26. So Judah acknowledged them and said, "She has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah, my son." And he never knew her again. Tamar is righteous because she desires to bear a son for the family of Judah. For this, she will be recognized in the book of Ruth in the people's blessing to Boaz. In Ruth 4:12, it says, "May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring which Jehovah will give you from this young woman." Now, one more thing about Judah and his sons. His first two sons are never again mentioned, but his third son, Shelah, is mentioned in the families belonging to the tribe of Judah. Shelah was not qualified to be in the lineage of Messiah, but that did not exempt him from being part of the family. We see in Numbers 26:20, "And the sons of Judah, according to their families, were of Shelah, the family of the Shelanites, of Perez, the family of the Parzites, of Zerah, the family of the Zarhites." Cool. All right, that concludes the commentary on Genesis 38, so let's go ahead and look at Genesis 39.
Genesis 39. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites, who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house, and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and after a time his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said,
"Lie with me."
But he refused and said to his master's wife,
"Behold, because of me my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?"
And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. But one day, when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying,
"Lie with me."
But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them,
"See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house."
Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home, and she told him the same story, saying,
"The Hebrew servant
servant whom you have brought among us came in to me to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house.
As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him,
"This is the way your servant treated me,"
his anger was kindled, and Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. Genesis 40. Sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker committed an offense against their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them. They continued for some time in custody, and one night they both dreamed, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers, who were with him in custody in his master's house,
"Why are your faces downcast today?"
They said to him,
"We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them."
And Joseph said to them,
"Do not interpretations belong to God? Please, tell them to me."
So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him,
"In my dream there was a vine before me, and on the vine there were three branches. As soon as it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and the clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand."
Then Joseph said to him,
"This is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. In 3 days Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly, when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me when it is well with you, and please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh, and so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit."
When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph,
"I also had a dream. There were 3 cake baskets on my head, and in the uppermost basket there were all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh. But the birds were eating it out of the basket on my head."
And Joseph answered and said,
"This is its interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. In 3 days Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh from you."
On the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants, and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him.
All right, I decided to go ahead and play 39 and 40 together because they're connected, so I just went ahead and did that. I'm going to pick up where I left off in this other guy's commentary. He says, in our Dell from yourlivingwaters.com, he says, "Let's finish with a look at Joseph. At the beginning of our study, Joseph was the favorite son of his father. Joseph is then sold by his brothers, and he descends to Egypt, where he ends up as a slave of Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh. He works himself into a privileged position, but after an unfair accusation, he ended up in prison. In Genesis 39:20, then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in the prison. This is Joseph's new life. He is now living with the wretched and condemned. Like Yeshua's descent, it's a far cry from the life he led with his father in an elevated position. But as we have seen, this is all part of the Almighty's sovereign plan. Like Judah, Joseph must learn and possess the virtue of humility necessary for leadership. It was Joseph's own dreams that led to his misfortunes, but it will be the dreams of others and his attributing his interpretation skills to Elohim that will lead him to prosperity. The narratives of Genesis are more than just stories. There are many layers of meaning associated with each of them. There is a concept in Judaism called Ma'aseh Avot Siman Labanim, if I said that right, which means the actions of the forefathers serve as a sign for their descendants. These are the cycles that we see in history. History repeats itself. It's all the more reason to study and meditate on these incredible stories. Amen to that, Ardell. Some good commentaries there from yourlivingwaters.com. Oh, I got somebody else here in the... Oh, somebody just was there and they just disappeared. Come back! I saw you, but now you're gone. Bummer. All right, well, I don't really have too much more that I could add to that story. Amy, do you have anything that you would like to share with regards to the last two chapters?
No, not really. I think that it's interesting how Joseph kept having to interpret all these dreams for people. And he had such a gift. Everybody could see how he was blessed. But he kept ending up in these situations where, you know, God put him in a really humbling circumstance.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is he maintains a good attitude to the whole thing, you know?
Oh, yeah. He never lost his faith.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, hey, why are you guys down? You know, I mean, he's in prison himself, you know, plenty of reasons to be down, but he's like, hey, why are you guys so down?
Yeah.
Then he starts interpreting dreams and says, hey, you know, remember me when you get out of here. But of course, we'll see next week that they didn't until like 13 years later or something like that.
But, wow.
Yeah, pretty wild deal. But that's, you know, it all formed him to be the suffering servant, but also a servant leader.
Yeah.
We'll see later. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead then and move on to the Haftor portion, which is Amos chapter 2 and 3. I'll go ahead and play that here. And while you guys listen to this, see if you can figure out what the tie-in is to the Genesis portion that we just listened to. This is Amos chapter 2, beginning in verse 6.
Amos 2. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they sold the righteous for silver, and the poor for a pair of shoes, that pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor, and turn aside the way of the meek. And a man and his father will go in unto the same maid, to profane my holy name. And they lay themselves down upon clothes laid to pledge by every altar, and they drink the wine of the condemned in the house of their God. Yet destroyed I the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and he was strong as the oaks. Yet I destroyed his fruit from above and his roots from beneath. Also I brought you up from the land of Egypt, and led you 40 years through the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. And I raised up of your sons for prophets, and of your young men for Nazarites. Is it not even thus, O ye children of Israel, saith the Lord? But ye gave the Nazarites wine to drink, and commanded the prophets, saying, Prophesy not. Behold, I am pressed under you, as a cart is pressed that is full of sheaves. Therefore the flight shall perish from the swift, and the strong shall not strengthen his force, neither shall the mighty deliver himself. Neither shall he stand that handleth the bow, and he that is swift of foot shall not deliver himself. Neither shall he that rideth the horse deliver himself. And he that is courageous among the mighty shall flee away naked in that day, saith the Lord. Amos 3. Hear this word that the Lord hath spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family which I brought up from the land of Egypt, saying, You only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. Can two walk together, except they be agreed? Will a lion roar in the forest when he hath no prey? Will a young lion cry out of his den if he have taken nothing? Can a bird fall in a snare upon the earth, where no gin is for him? Shall one take up a snare from the earth and have taken nothing at all? Shall a trumpet be blown in the city, and the people not be afraid? Shall there be evil in a city, and the Lord hath not done it? Surely the Lord God will do nothing, but he revealeth his secret unto his servants the prophets. The lion hath roared. Who will not fear? The Lord God hath spoken. Who can but prophesy?
There's a couple of things that I saw here right off the bat. We see in chapter 2 there that they sold the righteous for silver. That would be the obvious tie-in with Joseph being sold for silver. But I saw something really interesting with regard to the Amorite. Amos 2:9 is a scripture that I've quoted a lot in my presentations and shows and seminars and books and DVDs and whatnot regarding the Amorite. The Amorites are descendants of Canaan, and they are Nephilim. They are very big. This is the scripture that gives you the height of the Amorites. It tells you they were as tall as cedar trees. Cedar trees, a modest cedar tree, grows to about 35 feet tall. Of course, the cedars of Lebanon were 150 feet tall, so, you know, but even on the small side, these guys were huge. I mean, he's saying that he was as tall as the cedar trees and strong as the oaks. This is one seriously big dude. But, and so, the tie-in there, we see that Judah married into the Canaanites. The Amorites were sons of the Canaanites. Okay. Ham produced Canaan. Canaan produced Amorius. The Amorites came from Amorius. So we see Judah marrying into the Canaanite, you know, essentially marrying a Nephilim. And this is obviously, you know, as Elie Marzulli would say, a move and counter move, cosmic chess match deal going on here, where the seed was, the devil was trying to make a move to corrupt the seed that would lead to Messiah by having Judah marry a Canaanite woman. Of course, through Operation Leverage with Tamar, that plan was foiled by God, and so the devil didn't win that way. But it's like God is getting back at him here in Amos. And this is the tie-in to the Torah portion right here, as he's saying that the Canaanites of Nephilim, to try to prevent the seed of Messiah from coming in the first place, he said, I've destroyed them. He said, especially these big guys here, the root of below and the fruit above, that's essentially talking about ancestry and descendants, that God is the one responsible for wiping these guys out, and of course, in many ways, doing so through his people. But I'm beginning to think that the big ones, like the 35-footers that scared the Hebrew spies when they first went in the land in Numbers 13, they said, man, we feel like grasshoppers compared to these guys. You know, a 6-footer beside a 35-footer would make you feel like a grasshopper. And it scared them, and it was because of their unbelief and fear that they were made to wander in the wilderness for 40 years until that generation died off. But the ones who were not afraid, like Caleb and Joshua, were preserved and allowed to go into the land afterwards. But I think that during that time of the 40-year wandering, God was wiping out the really big guys, taking them out. Because when you see the Israelites engaging again with these Amorites, like the king of Sihon and Og of Bashan, you know, you're looking at 15, 18-footer. You know, it's still an impressive big guy, but not like a 35-footer. It's about half the size. So God cut them down to a more reasonable size for the Israelites to be courageous enough to wipe out, I guess. Although Caleb appears to have wanted to just pick up where he left off 40 years earlier, because he's like, give me a Kiriath Arba. Give me Arba. Arba was the father of Anak, who was the father of the Anakim, who were the 35 porters, as they saw in Numbers 13. So, you know, Caleb's ready to pick up where he left off 40 years prior and go after whatever the big guys were left. But it appears to be saying that God's talking about the ones that were size of cedar trees as strong as oaks, and that he took them out. So there's another tie-in right there. And then in the beginning of Amos chapter 3, we see that God's declaring Israel as his family. You know, hear this word that Jehovah has spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family, which I brought up from the land of Egypt, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. This is his family. And by the way, if you've accepted Yeshua, the Son of God, as your Savior, that's the family you're grafted into. There's not some mystical entity out there called the church. The church is grafted in. It's the wild olive branch grafted into the cultivated olive branch, which is this family right here. And as we were looking at earlier, if you're not blood related to one of those 12 sons of Jacob, you come in under the banner of Ephraim. And we'll talk more about that this week, especially probably on Friday when we read Ezekiel 37. So, well, in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and move on to the New Testament portion so we can get everybody out of here at a reasonable hour. Instead of going 3 hours, the show ends anyway by itself on the live feed at 11:30. So rather than going off line, I'll just go ahead and wrap us up here with the New Testament portion, which is Acts 7, 9 through 16, and Revelation 12, 1 through 17. And I'm going to put the link in the chat room for anybody who wants to follow along with me. I'm going to read from the easier-to-read New Living Translation. It says, Acts 7, beginning in verse 9, these patriarchs were jealous of their brother Joseph, and they sold him to be a slave in Egypt. But God was with him and rescued him from his troubles. And God gave him favor before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. God also gave Joseph unusual wisdom, so that Pharaoh appointed him governor over all of Egypt and put him in charge of the palace. And we see that was, well, that's an obvious tie-in right there where he's sold into slavery. But we see the beginning of some training. I mean, God always prepares you in advance for whatever he has called you to do in the future. And so, yeah, while he had to deal with some unfortunate circumstances, being sold into slavery and spending time in the pit and going to prison, being unjustly accused and all that, but it was in that time, that time in prison, that he acquired the skill of dream interpretation. You know, the whole thing starts off with, I have a dream! Got him in trouble. But later he becomes a dream interpreter. But that was some early training. I mean, he understood that he got that ability from God. And then when Pharaoh, we're going to find out in the next study tomorrow night, that when Pharaoh had a dream, nobody else could interpret it. Joseph had already been prepared in advance to be able to do that. And that's what impressed the Pharaoh and caused him, Joseph, to be elevated to second in charge of all of Egypt, second only to the Pharaoh. Pretty cool. Picking up where we left off, and this is Stephen's testimony here in Acts chapter 7. But famine came upon Egypt and Canaan. And I speculate on this, but, you know, if we have Amorites walking around the size of cedar trees, and the land was full of them, it says that, you know, the land was full of these people. They were everywhere, and whenever they use the term grasshoppers, that it means two things. They're comparing themselves in height, but grasshoppers is also used throughout the Bible. You know, when they say that the army was so vast that they numbered as grasshoppers, you know, it's a reference to numbers also. So when you think of that many people in the land walking around the size of cedar trees, it's pretty easy to see why there was so many famines in the land. I mean, it takes a lot of food to feed a guy like that. So this is an observation that I had looking at all these different famines that kept taking place and who was in the land. It just makes sense that there might be some famines. And Dory says she was on a BK run. Yeah, well, these guys were eating an awful lot too. Let's see here. There was great misery, and our ancestors ran out of food. Jacob heard that there was still grain in Egypt, so he sent his sons, our ancestors, to buy some. The second time they went, Joseph revealed his identity to his brothers, and they were introduced to Pharaoh. Then Joseph sent for his father Jacob and all his relatives to come to Egypt, 75 persons in all. So Jacob went to Egypt, and he died there, as did our ancestors. Their bodies were taken to Shechem and buried in the tomb Abraham had bought for a certain price from Hamor's sons in Shechem. And how interesting that these guys are buried in Shechem, especially if my theory is true, that Shechem is over the trees in the Garden of Eden. Everything keeps going back to that. Pretty cool. So that's the portion from Acts. Now let's look at Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 through 17. Then I witnessed in heaven an event of great significance. I saw a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon beneath her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant, and she cried out because of her labor pains and the agony of giving birth. Then I witnessed in heaven another significant event. I saw a large red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, with 7 crowns on his head. His tail swept away 1/3 of the stars in the sky, and he threw them down to the earth. He stood in front of the woman as she was about to give birth, ready to devour her baby as soon as it was born. And this is something interesting, guys. Some of you have heard me talk about this before, but we know in Genesis that the sun, moon, and stars are put in the skies for times and for seasons, and they're there for signs to tell us stuff. You know, there's books out there like Gospel in the Stars that God put his entire plan illustrated in what we call the Zodiac or the Maseroth in Scripture. These are the heavenly signs. And he said the sign that would in the heavens that indicate his birth is a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon at her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. That is a celestial sign that signifies Christ's birth. Now, we've already talked about it at length, that he was not born on December 25th. That's why I refuse to celebrate Christ's birthday. You can't put Christ in Christmas when he was never there to begin with. December 25th has nothing to do with Jesus, nothing. Everything to do with the Antichrist. And so when we try to think about when he was born, obviously he was born during the fall feast season, the Feast of Jehovah. Now the question is, was it trumpets, atonement, or tabernacles? Now I know a lot of people subscribe to the idea that it was tabernacles, and I've heard a lot of very good and compelling arguments for that. The problem I have with the tabernacles argument, however, is right here in Revelation chapter 12. Because Revelation chapter 12 is describing an event that took place in history. You could go look this up for yourself. Go on stellarium.org. Stellarium.org. I'll put the note in the extra section. I'll put a link to it. And I'll put a link in the chat room here. You could go to stellarium.org and download the free software there. And use the software to back the date off to September 11th. Yep, that's right, September 11th, 3 BC. I'm putting the link in the chat room there. You could now, if you go to 3 BC, the software actually reckons it as -2 because there's no year zero. So 3 BC is in the software, -2. So if you back the software off to -2 to September 11th, you will see this event in the sky. Now, what you also have to do, and I give instructions for this on my blog as well as in Babylon Rising, and the first shall be last, and I think it's the last chapter, chapter 8. I give step-by-step instructions on how to do this because you actually have to set some things up on your computer too, like set your time on your computer to be the time for Israel. Set your location on in the software to be Jerusalem, so it's reckoning in the software. You're like you're standing in the Middle East, and your clock is set to Middle East time when you do this. And if you do it right, you can look up and you'll see at about 5 o'clock in the morning ish this event. Virgo is the woman clothed with the sun. The sun is in her belly. It's just before sunrise, and the moon is at her feet. And it's the beginning of it's just starting to crescent. So it's right after the new moon, which is the dark moon, going into the crescent phase. and with the nine stars of Leo above her head and the three planets of Mercury, Venus, and Jupiter all right there, you got the 12 stars in her head, the sun in her belly, and the moon in her feet. That exact alignment happens on September 11th, 3 BC, which is during the Feast of Trumpets, not the Feast of Atonement, not the Day of Atonement, nor the Feast of Tabernacles. But you know what I say to people? I say, look, you know, that's when the celestial event takes place. It takes place at the beginning of the fall feast season. But, you know, maybe he did get born in, he was born in Tabernacles, so why not just celebrate his birthday for 3 whole weeks? You know, trade a pagan day, one pagan Antichrist day, for 3 weeks of partying and celebrating Yeshua's birth. Woohoo! That's a good deal. That's one of the feasts that actually comes with the commandment to have fun. You are commanded, I know I'm getting legalistic here, but you are commanded to have fun. Even drink strong drink. You can do that too. And, you know, Baptists, you can go ahead and plug your ears right now. Drink strong drink during that time. Drink strong drink and use your tithe money to pay for it. How crazy is that? So celebrate Christ's birth right there in Revelation chapter 12. You can start at Feast of Trumpets and go all the way through Tabernacles, although there is the solemn day in the middle there, of the Day of Atonement, so be careful with that. But anyway, I digress. So, she shall give, we'll pick up in chapter 12, verse 5. She gave birth to a son who was to rule all nations with an iron rod, and her child was snatched away from the dragon and was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness where God had prepared a place to care for her for 1260 days. Then there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon and his angels. And the dragon lost the battle, and he and his angels were forced out of heaven. This great dragon, the ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, the one deceiving the whole world, was thrown down to the earth with all his angels. And this is a parallel to Isaiah chapter 14, if you want to pick up for the rest of the story. This, in my opinion, is the only second incursion written about in the Bible, is when the devil repeats what the watchers of Genesis 6 did. And the reason I know this is the only second incursion is because it's the only other example of an angel mating with women. We see in Isaiah 14, after he's cast down, O how thou art fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, that he has children, and that God goes after his children. So clearly he produced some children. And the prescribed judgment for angels who mate with women is being bound in chains and cast into the bottomless pit that is Tartarus, the prison of the gods. That's why you see later on in Revelation that an angel binds the devil, that serpent, Satan, in chains for 1,000 years before he's cast into the lake of fire. So he has two judgments. The lake of fire was always prepared for him, but because he mates with women, he has to receive the exact same judgment as the watchers of Genesis chapter 6. The prescribed judgment for mating with women is being bound in chains and put in Tartarus. And that's exactly the reason why the devil is bound in chains for 1,000 years and put into the prison of the fallen, which is Tartarus, the bottomless pit, the abyss. And so that's the parallel in Isaiah 14 is to what happens here in Revelation 12. Let's pick up where I left off here, verse 10. Then I heard a loud voice shouting across the heavens, "It has come at last, salvation and power, the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters has been thrown down to earth, the one who accuses them before our God day and night. And they have defeated him by the blood of the Lamb and by their testimony." Notice it doesn't say anything about anybody raptured out. Talking about people here defeating the devil after he's cast down. I don't know why I even believe this whole pre-tribulation rapture thing. The time when the world needs us the most, why in the world would we think that we're being taken out of here? When the precedence throughout the entire Bible is the bad guys get wiped away and the good guys get left behind. You know, Noah got in this little earthbound place of safety, was lifted up for a little while, bad guys wiped away, let back down. You know, it didn't leave the earth. He left the ground, but he didn't leave the planet. Lot, same thing. Before judgment came down on Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot and his family were escorted to an earthbound place of safety while the bad guys were wiped away. During the Exodus, during the judgments of Egypt, the Israelites were preserved in the land of Goshen while all the wrath of God was being poured out in the rest of Egypt. Bad guys being wiped away, good guys stay behind. Pharaoh's army chased the Israelites through the Red Sea. God parts the sea. gets the Israelites safely through. As the bad guys come, they get washed away. Over and over and over again, we see bad guys taken away, good guys left behind. So I don't know why everybody wants to think that, you know, we got this rapture thing with the good guys being taken away and the bad guys being left behind. That doesn't make any sense at all. And also, I just noticed something in the book of Enoch. The very beginning of the book of Enoch, chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, says, the words of the blessing of Enoch, with which he blessed the elect and righteous who will be living in the day of tribulation, when all the wicked and godless are to be removed. It even says in the book of Enoch that it's the bad guys taken away, not the good guys, when all the wicked and the godless are to be removed. And this message, the book of Enoch, is there for the benefit of those good guys who are going to be left behind, so we understand what's going on. That's why he gave us this book, and I believe why God preserved it for such a time as this. Verse 2 says, and he began his story saying, Enoch, a righteous man whose eyes were opened by God, saw the vision of the Holy One in heaven, with the angels showed me, which the angels showed me, and I heard everything from them, and I saw and understood, but it was not for this generation, but for a remote one, a future one, which is to come. That's us, guys. We're the good guys. This is our planet. God made this planet for us. And by the way, everybody thinks that they're going to heaven when they die. There may be a short time that you're there, but our ultimate destination is here. Read it. Read the end of Revelation. You know, New Jerusalem comes down from heaven to earth after the millennial reign of Christ. And then there's a new heaven and a new earth. Now, our destination is here. God made this place for us. You know, whatever time we may spend in heaven, apparently it's temporary. Anyway, just some thoughts on that. They were defeated by him. They defeated him, excuse me, and they have defeated him by the blood of the Lamb and by their testimony. And they did not love their lives so much that they were afraid to die. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who live in the heavens, rejoice. But terror will come on the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you in great anger, knowing that his time, that he has a very little time. When the dragon realized that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the child, to the male child. But she was given two wings like those of a great eagle, so she could fly to the place prepared for her in the wilderness. There she would be cared for and protected from the dragon for a time, or 3.5 years, as we would say. Then the dragon tried to drown the woman with a flood of water that flowed from his mouth, but the earth helped her by opening its mouth and swallowed the river that gushed out from the mouth of the dragon. And the dragon was angry at the woman and declared war against the rest of her children, all who keep, what? God's commandments and maintain their testimony for Jesus. I don't have time to go into this. I've talked about it many times before, but I believe what this is referring to is the people who didn't go into a place of safety earlier. I do believe that there is a hiding prior to the tribulation for the five wise virgins that go in with the bridegroom, not up. It says they go in and he shut the door. In, not up, just like in Noah's Ark. They went in and God shut the door. Same thing at the beginning of the tribulation. There's five wise who go in and the bridegroom shuts the door. And Jesus said just prior to Matthew 25 and Matthew 24:37 that the last days would be like the days of Noah. So you've got to make that connection. So again, and I don't have time. We got like 2 minutes left before the show's going to end here. But the wise are those who obey and keep the commandments and observe the feasts, which are the appointed times that are supposed to be a mikra, something that we rehearse. Why do we mikra them? Why do we rehearse them? So that we are prepared, that we're ready, that we're wise, that we have oil in our vessels with our lamps on the appointed time when he comes back. And I believe that those are the ones that are preserved at the beginning. There's another Yom HaKaseh. There's another Hebrew term for the Feast of Trumpets or Yom Teruah. Yom Teruah is Feast of Trumpets. Yom HaKaseh, if I'm saying that right, is another name for that same exact feast, which means the day of hiding. So I believe that's what it's talking about. For those who are wise and keeping the commandments and observing the feast and are ready and prepared, as 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, that nobody wants to read. Everybody reads 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And they say, well, Jesus is coming back in a day. No one knows the day or the hour. He's coming like a thief in the night. Read the next chapter. Chapter 5 tells you he will not come as a thief in the night to those who are watching, ready, waiting, and prepared. And he says, I have no need to tell you of signs and seasons. Why does he say that? Because they're already observing them, as we should. And if we will, I believe we'll be in the category of the wise. But there's the other five who are virgins, which means they're pure. They're waiting for their bridegroom. The only ones that do that are Christians. So the five foolish, I believe, are not disobedient Christians who are not obeying the Father out of love. It's not about salvation. We get that through by grace through faith in Christ alone. But they're not doing it out of love. And therefore, they're clueless. They're not watching, ready, waiting, prepared. And they're clueless. So they have to go through this thing. And they become tribulation martyrs. But I believe this is what's being spoken of right here. The rest of her children who keep the commandments and maintain the testimony. I believe through the fire, they become commandment and feast-keeping believers. That's all the time I have for tonight. We will pick up where we left off tomorrow night. Keep watching my Facebook for the time. I'm not quite sure what time I'm going to do it, but we'll do the next portion tomorrow night. And so with that, I say good night, everybody. We'll see you back next time on the Revolutionary Radio Project.
Hey, you, with a rhinestone dog collar. Between us dogs, I just convinced my human to upgrade to a new home with a 1,200-square-foot bathroom. I think she called it a yard. With Wells Fargo's 3% down mortgage option, my human realized a new home was within reach, and I only gave her puppy eyes once. Get your human to talk to a mortgage consultant or learn more at wellsfargo.com/woof.
Wells Fargo Home Mortgage. Down payments as low as 3% on a fixed-rate loan require mortgage insurance. Ask a home mortgage consultant about loan requirements. Wells Fargo Home Mortgage is a division of Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., Equal Housing Lender, NMLS ID 399801.